We appreciate it, and thanks for being here in Tucson.
It's 10:59 here at KBOO Portland, and it's time for the food show. Stay tuned. One little announcement, and then we'll get right to the food show. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
This is DJ Love Jones, producer of the world-famous Confessional and DJ for Necropolis, starting every Sunday, midnight to 3 a.m. I want to personally invite you to come on out to the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, February 21st, starting at 7 p.m. Contessa de la Luna, host of the world-famous Confessional, will be live on stage reading your secrets and confessions prior to the movie. There'll be prizes. Come on out for a fun evening that benefits your community radio station, KBOO. That's Blazing Saddles, Thursday, February 21st, starting at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. See you there.
Welcome to the food show. My name is Emily Becker, and we're talking about labor in the food system today. We'll speak with food system workers in fast food restaurants, grocery stores, and on the farm. Emmett Schlins of the Burgerville Workers Union will talk about the fight for better wages and working conditions and forming the nation's first fast food restaurant union. David Adams and Isaac Bird will give us updates on the New Seasons Workers United campaign to organize New Seasons stores. And to close out the show, Matt Gordon of Rogue Valley Farm Corps and Cully Neighborhood Farm will discuss working on farms and training the next generation of farmers. First, let's talk fast food. The Burgerville Workers Union began organizing about 2 years ago to increase their wages and make Burgerville a better place to work. The union is in a bargaining session today, and Emmett Schlins is joining us by phone. Hi, Emmett. Welcome to the food show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
So are you in the middle of a bargaining session right now?
Yes. I just stepped outside of the bargaining room to take this call, but we have plenty of smart, very capable folks in there holding it down.
Excellent. So let's start at the beginning. Tell us why people started organizing at Burgerville restaurants. What were the concerns besides low wages?
Low wages is one of the biggest ones. We get paid more or less minimum wage, maybe a little bit above it. But as like most people who work minimum wage in Portland know, it's just factually not enough to live on. It's extremely difficult to pay rent. It's extremely difficult to buy groceries, let alone save, let alone put money in the bank for emergencies, or to be secure and not stressed out all the time about money. So that was one big one. But some of our other concerns that led to this unionization effort were fair and consistent scheduling, making sure that people had the hours that they needed regularly enough so they had a paycheck they could count on, better and more accessible health care for Burgerville workers. Burgerville likes to say that they're one of the first people to provide health care to their workers, but the vast majority, I would say, of Burgerville workers aren't actually on this health care plan because they're not eligible, because they don't work enough hours, or they're kept below the hours threshold, and that additionally, the healthcare program that Burgerville does offer, like simply put, isn't good enough. It's not up to standard for the needs of Burgerville workers. So the two of the big ones, and then the third most important one would be protection for undocumented workers. We want to make sure that folks who are undocumented, who are working at Burgerville, have the maximum amount of protection under the law to work there. We don't believe that your right to a safe workplace is contingent on your documentation. We believe that everybody has that right. So we're fighting for that as well.
Excellent. Wow, there's a lot there. Can you just talk a little bit about what Burgerville is? There's a lot of people who listen to our show who don't live in the Portland metro area.
Sure. So Burgerville is like a local Pacific Northwest fast food chain. About 42 stores, so not huge, but also it's not a small business. It's fairly large. They're all over Oregon and all over Washington. The most relevant, the most salient sort of detail about Burgerville is that their branding is as this very progressive company with progressive ideas, progressive policies, sort of emphasis on environmental sustainability. And that's relevant because that sort of attitude, that marketing strategy, has never trickled down into how they treat their workers. They talk a big game about being a progressive, ethical company, but when it comes down to it, not only are they still paying us poverty wages, not only are they, not only did they refuse to negotiate and bargain with the workers for 2 years before we won our first union election back in April of last year. But during the unionization process, they actively fought the organizing efforts. A lot of my personal friends were fired for their work towards building a union about a year and a half ago, I would say, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. Burgerville actually brought armed security guards armed with guns. I'm not being hyperbolic to our picket lines outside of restaurants to intimidate workers. And they haven't done that in a long time after the union called them out on it, but it was a thing that they did. So they have this reputation. For people who don't know Burgerville, they have this reputation being a progressive company, but we have not seen any of that reputation, both in the way that they treat us and the way that they respond to the union. And it really has just become this big flashy marketing campaign without any real substance.
Yeah, that's probably really surprising to a lot of our listeners. I think people think about Burgerville as, you know, a local independent store. They care a lot about locally grown food and they have, you know, seasonal options. And a lot of times when you have restaurants that are like, we care about farms and we care about the local economy, you think that would trickle down to the workers. And then, you know, them saying things like they give healthcare to workers and things like that. Tell us a little bit more about how the healthcare works and why that isn't actually helpful.
Sure. So a few years ago, I think when they first initiated this healthcare policy, you were eligible for healthcare under Burgerville's program if you worked 20 hours a week. And then they changed it a couple years ago to 30 hours a week. And the vast majority of Burgerville workers don't work 30 hours a week. So they're rendered ineligible for this program. And a lot of people experience it. The way that they experience it is that they're being kept under 30 hours so that they won't be eligible, so that Burgerville won't have to provide them health care or health insurance. That's the way that workers are experiencing it when they like consistently get 28 or 9 hours, but not actually that 30 cutoff. And with regards to quality, there are a lot of stories of workers who go in for treatment, even for work-related injuries or work-related strains. I have a coworker whose wrist, she has like developed carpal tunnel because she's been flipping burgers for 15 years at Burgerville. And then they come to find out that like the healthcare coverage isn't going to cover the necessary treatment. So that's like the other concern is both in quality, both in what you can get from Burgerville's healthcare, which we want to be better, and in regards to how much you have to work to be eligible, which we want to be more accessible.
Yeah, it's pretty unusual for a restaurant to offer health insurance, which makes me think that, you know, the kind of people who are organizing this union and that work at these shops aren't what you might normally think of as a fast food worker. I think a lot of people think of, you know, like a 15-year-old kid who's having their first job and not somebody who needs health insurance and who has developed injuries because of working on the job. Can you tell us a little bit about who the union is, who's organizing, and what Burgerville workers are like?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally hear what you're saying about people oftentimes thinking of fast food workers as like 15-year-old kids working for like extra spending on money on the weekends. That was my perspective for a long time, and it's a wrong-headed perspective. The majority of my coworkers are over 18. There may be somebody who's under 18, but I can't think of who they are at the moment. And a lot of them not only have worked at Burgerville for over a decade, but are like well into adulthood in their 30s, 40s, even 50s sometimes. And that's just at my store. I have worked with people much older than that. I have know people who work at Burgerville who are much older than that, much older than 15 or 16. We have kids. We have debt. We're taking care of family members. A lot of the times when a worker is young, is in their like in their teens or early 20s, they're frequently the sole income for the household, that this is the job they could get, and that they're the ones who are providing for their entire household. So simply put, I think a lot of the time, the idea that, oh, fast food workers, they're just 16-year-olds, is a way of like society rationalizing not paying fast food workers more. It's like rationalizing the minimum wage. And even then, I would push back and say, it doesn't matter if you're 16, it doesn't matter if you're 17. You deserve to be compensated fairly for your work. That age has nothing to do with it. We all deserve a living wage, regardless of age.
Absolutely. So Burgerville Workers Union is maybe a little bit different than other kinds of unions that people have heard about, just because of the style of organizing you all are doing, and also that you're affiliated with the IWW. So can you talk a little bit about what that looks like and the kinds of organizing you're doing, and also just like where you're at in the process? I think you have three shops that are that have held elections, and you're bargaining right now. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So yeah, we have won three elections. We've won all of our elections. We haven't lost one yet. Fingers crossed. Not fingers crossed. Well, we're never going to lose one. That is a message to the Burgerville corporate that we're never going to lose one.
Never.
And never, ever. So yeah, we are in contract negotiations. We've been in contract negotiations for about 9 months now, since the summer. And things are progressing. We have reached some tentative agreements with the company. We have, made some progress. But overall, on some of our key concerns, most importantly, wages, we've actually yet to hear back from the company. They were supposed to bring their wage proposal today about like what they think is fair for us, and they didn't, which we're very frustrated with.
And what are you all asking for?
Our demand has been the same since we've been public, which is a $5 an hour raise for all hourly workers.
Great.
Yeah. So not the $15 minimum, because while that was a very useful productive horizon a few years ago, cost of living has only gone up since then, and it's not enough anymore.
Exactly.
So yeah, our demand is a flat $5 an hour raise. Yeah. And to talk a little bit about like the style of organizing or the model, we don't have a big union staff. We don't have any union staff for that matter. It's a predominantly worker and volunteer driven organization. So when we're talking about who's doing the work, who's making the union happen, it's me, it's my coworkers, it's people who work at other Burgervilles, and our friends and our family and the people who we care about and who care about us. It's not one of the things that Burgerville likes to try to frame us as this like third party that's coming in and trying to cause trouble. Which is wrong for a whole host of reasons, ethically as a thing to say, but like even factually, like I'm not a third party. I work at Burgerville. The people who don't work at Burgerville who are helping out with the union effort are my friends, and they're helping out because they care about me and they want me and my coworkers to have better lives. And that sort of like volunteer emphasis and that worker-oriented emphasis that like workers are doing the organizing work is sort of a distinct model. I don't mean to knock like other more established, more standardized modes of union organizing, but I think it has worked very well for us given the sort of limitations on organizing in the fast food industry, the super high turnover rates, and the fact that there are 42 Burgervilles all over two states as opposed to one factory with a ton of people working there. I think that this emphasis on like worker-centered organizing and workers building relationships with their coworkers to build the union is what has contributed to a lot of our success. It's what's made us sustainable.
That's awesome. So you've got three shops that have held elections, and you guys are all bargaining together. Are there other shops that are still organizing and hoping to hold elections in the future?
Yes, I can't speak to whether or not they're planning on holding elections, but we do have like public union presence in a variety of other stores. The ones that I could talk about publicly would be the location of Montevilla, which is famous for this big uproar about anti-fascist and anti-racist buttons that workers there were wearing. It wasn't just that store, but that was the store that got a lot of attention. We have an active union presence at the Convention Center Burgerville, which is famous for the numerous pickets and protests that we've held outside over the last few years. The airport is another public union store. The 26th and Powell location is another public union store. Those are the ones that I can talk about publicly.
So even though the workers at those stores aren't included in your bargaining right now, would they still be covered with any contract you get?
It's a sort of an open question right now, how those stores would enter into the bargaining unit and become like covered under the contract. Obviously, our goal is to cover as many stores and as many workers under a fair contract as we can. And however we end up doing that, it is our goal.
That's great. So you mentioned a little earlier that as you started organizing, Burgerville responded with some pretty heavy-handed anti-union tactics. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, including people getting fired and anything else?
Yeah, there was a sort of relatively famous incident within the campaign. So if you've been following the campaign, I'm sure you've heard about it, when a worker at a store in Vancouver was fired for eating a bagel that his manager handed to him without paying for the bagel. The manager waited 24 hours to ask him about it, and then as soon as he asked him about it, suspended him for stealing this bagel that the manager gave to him.
What would a Burgerville worker pay for a bagel?
70 cents, maybe. So, less than a dollar for sure. And he ended up being fired for it. So the way we experience it and the way we perceive it is that it was a pretty clear attempt at getting Jordan was his name, Jordan Vandering, getting Jordan fired for organizing because his manager handed them this bagel. His manager never asked him to pay for it. He never said, "Oh, Jordan, you forgot to pay for this bagel that I personally handed you." And then the next day, came in and suspended them and later fired him. And those sorts of things have repeated over the last 2 years. There have been people fired for throwing away a chicken patty at the convention center. There have been people fired for putting a little bit of ice cream in their coffee after a manager said that they could and that was fine to do. They were fired for it. I think most recently, it wasn't a firing, but it happened at my store during our union election. Because I work at the Hawthorne store and we won our union election in December. Burgerville came out during the election with some pretty hardcore anti-union propaganda at our store that we hadn't seen before. And the concerning thing about it, I mean, there was a lot of concerning things about it, but one of the more concerning things was that the language that they were using about unions as like outside agitators, about unions just like wanting to take your money, about unions unions stepping in between you negotiating individually with the company, are all extremely common arguments for like the very far right to work movement that's like propagated by right wing labor activists who want to smash unions across the country. We've seen right to work legislation pass in more conservative states over the last few years, and it always leads to a reduction in union strength and a reduction in wages and poorer working conditions. And it's extremely troubling to see Burgerville's rhetoric about unions really lining up behind this like far right labor agenda. Which was surprising, to be frank.
Yeah. So, Emmett, we've only got a couple more minutes, but I really want to hear about what, you know, the community response has been to your union and what people can do to support the Burgerville Workers Union.
Yeah, absolutely. The community support has been nothing short of inspiring and moving, oftentimes to tears. I'm calling you right now from the Jobs with Justice offices in Northeast Portland, who like very generously provide space for us to have our contract negotiation meetings We get support from other unions, like the Carpenters, Local 1503, other sort of like social justice progressive organizations. The support has been incredible, and we're extremely grateful for it. If people are looking to get involved in the Bergamo Workers Union campaign, a great place to follow is the Facebook. That's the mode of communication we use the most often. People are always invited to come out to our actions, our picket lines. We love to see the community out there. And then the last thing I'll say too is that there is an active boycott on the company until they sign a fair contract. It's a thing that gets confused sometimes. People will see that we win an election and assume that the boycott is off. But to be honest, I don't really trust the company as far as I can throw them. So we're not going to call the boycott off until we get that fair contract, until we get the wages and the working conditions that we deserve. So when that happens, we will announce to the world. I will be thrilled to announce the end of the boycott. But it is on until it all stores until we sign a contract.
Is there anywhere people can find out more about the boycott besides Facebook?
Yeah, we have a website. We have a website that's www.boycottburgerville.com that has a lot of information on it. I think there's a link on our Facebook page as well, which is just Bergerville Workers Union. If somebody Googles Boycott Bergerville, they'll be able to find the website as well.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Emmett. Thanks for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and good luck with the bargaining.
Yeah, I hope it goes well.
Me too. Have a great day.
Thank you.
That was Emmett Schlins from the Bergerville Workers Union. In the studio today, I'm sitting with Isaac Bird, a cashier at the Williams New Seasons store, and David Adams, a former New Seasons worker at the Seven Corners store. Isaac and David are both organizing with the New Seasons Workers United. And they are here. David's a member of the Solidarity Committee. You have left your position at New Seasons, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Emily. Thank you.
Yeah. And Isaac, you're at the Williams store.
Yep, still cashiering.
Nice. Let's start at the beginning. Why do people start organizing? What were your initial concerns as workers?
I always like to start kind of with maybe the more philosophical aspect of it. Every worker deserves democracy at work. I think in this country specifically, we like to talk about democracy and us being a republic a lot. And I always find it interesting how that contrasts from like the public sphere, where everyone's always talking about making sure you get out and vote in elections, to the private sphere where most people really don't have any ability or control or ability to control the way their work moves, or the way their work moves them. Yeah. In terms of, I think, how our campaign started, organizing has been happening at New Seasons for a very long time, and there's been quite a lot of change in the company initiated by the workers, that the workers made the company do. Specifically, I think looking back at the Seven Corners New Seasons, there's a long history of organizing there.
Is that was the very first New Seasons? Is that right?
I believe Raleigh Hills was the first New Seasons. It's actually in the company, it's referred to as the mothership. but Seven Corners has a long history. There's still a lot of active organizing going on in that store. I think that probably started around 2012, and some of the people who were there at that time are still in that store, still trying to work with their coworkers to make sure that workers in that store are getting what they need.
And was there an incident, or did something happen, or was there like just kind of a general interest in having a better workplace? Like, what happened?
Yeah, there were all sorts of what some would consider like smaller workplace issues, like issues with equipment, unsafe equipment, or not enough equipment, such as like grocery carts, things like that, that workers organized around and won eventually. I think one of the most important or meaningful victories at that time was what New Seasons now claims is a part, as something that they did magnanimously, but it was actually a worker effort for trans-inclusive healthcare benefits. Workers at a variety of stores organized to make sure that was covered under the New Seasons health insurance. Mm-hmm. And now it is, thankfully.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So what's the, what's the actual structure of how you're organizing right now?
I mean, I think in a lot of ways we're very similar to the BVWU, the Burgerville Workers United campaign. We're fully worker run, worker organized right now. We're technically an independent campaign, although I'll boost out Portland DSA, Jobs with Justice, and local IWW for providing support of all kinds, including meeting locations and printing over the past year or so. We did start in our most recent iteration in terms of organizing at New Seasons as a UFCW 555 backed campaign. We are no longer working with them, and we've been fully independent since probably the beginning of 2018 summer.
Yeah, definitely. Emmett couldn't speak in what he said to working, the larger union, trade union forms of organizing. But UFCW had a very particular plan of how they wanted things to go. And I think very quickly we saw that we wanted something that was much more worker driven. We started having worker-run meetings, worker-only meetings, and that kind of transformed into a sort of a decentralized way of communicating. And we have a Facebook group. One of the things that I know that teachers in West Virginia did, for example, that was really helpful for their strike efforts was have private Facebook groups for each county and for each school location. And that's something that we've tried to model here. That's having a private Facebook group for workers at New Seasons to discuss issues. And that has proven very rich because lots of different things are happening at different stores in different ways. The company does not roll things out equally. It likes to do trial runs of structural changes at different stores all the time, and that affects workers on a day-to-day basis in different ways. But having the ability to communicate about those things has been really valuable in understanding what's happening, and then people can go together or individually and ask questions that are relevant to the I know that this is happening here, what is going on here. The company likes to play dumb, obviously. They don't.
So.
Yeah.
They're good at that.
But right now there are some intense changes going on at the company. Maybe Isaac can speak more to that.
Yeah, maybe in a minute we'll get to that.
Totally.
I just realized that much like Burgerville, people might not know what New Seasons is. Sure. And how its scope. Do one of you want to tell us what New Seasons is?
Yeah. New Seasons is a grocery store. There are, I think, 19 locations, including a central commissary kitchen in the Portland metro area, with some more stores in Northern California, and right now two stores, I believe, in Seattle. They may be opening a third, which has received a lot of pushback from the UFCW Local 21 in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Because they're a non-union store. Seattle has high grocery union density. I think New Seasons started maybe in 2000, early 2000s. And it started as a community grocery store, really oriented towards providing a mix of groceries, high-end and your standard Kellogg's and stuff like that. With this bent towards local food, treating their workers right. And I think that reputation, they've been riding that reputation ever since that time. It has definitely grown exponentially, especially since it was acquired by a private equity firm called Endeavor Capital, I think, in 2010-ish.
Somewhere in that vicinity.
Yeah. And that has come with a whole host of issues, but it certainly has a reputation as a progressive grocery store. They love to tell everyone that they're a B Corp, which is a independent certification using a variety of metrics. B Corp will come and look at all the data that New Seasons provides them and say, yes, you're a B Corp. That means you're a good company. And New Seasons likes to take down union posters and put up B Corp buttons in their place, which I find interesting, kind of gaslighty.
Yeah.
I don't know, is that
Yeah, that's great. Cool. So, you know, given the scope of the company, it must be really hard to organize. You know, you've got people across different shops in town and then also in three states. So it's awesome that you're using Facebook. Are you guys using other tools to help connect workers together?
Definitely. I mean, I would also, again, I'll kind of bounce back to what Emmett was saying earlier. I think relationships are really important for organizing. So we also take a very store-by-store approach. Really, at the end of the day, the stronger the community you can have between workers in a store, the more you can kind of develop that worker-to-worker solidarity. So people will be looking out for each other if, say, someone is being targeted by management, or if there are changes happening at that store level, workers can come together themselves in that store and support each other. So I think we definitely look at organizing as a very store-by-store thing. In terms of using tools for organizing, Facebook has been a really important one. And I think just seeing each other and communicating with each other outside of work, it's always a really, really endearing experience to kind of meet other coworkers from different locations at New Seasons mm-hmm. on your off time and kind of realize that, oh, this problem I may be experiencing at this store, you're also seeing the same thing at a completely different store in a totally far-flung part of Portland. It really builds that kind of, it's not just me, I think, solidarity feeling. It's you see how large and encompassing some of these issues within the company are.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what New Seasons' response has been to the union. I know that you've mentioned a couple of things that they've done that aren't very helpful. And I think they hired some law firm to come in and tell everybody that Union New Seasons is great. Do you guys want to tell us about all that?
The law firm. The law firm was called, it is called, it's probably still around, Cruz and Associates, run by a lawyer called Lupe Cruz. They're infamous for having done quite a lot of work for, I believe, the Trump chain of hotels in Las Vegas, where they failed to stop union organizing there. But Lupe Cruz and Cruz and Associates is a union avoidance law firm. That's on their website. It's what they specialize in.
They don't say busting.
They don't say busting. They're avoidance. They like their euphemisms. And New Seasons brought them in after we went public. In November of 2017, to do some meetings with the workers. So in the state of Oregon, it is illegal to have a mandatory meeting for, say, the purposes of trying to convince workers to not unionize. So New Seasons and Cruz and Associates did a bit of a workaround for this. They told workers that these meetings were happening. They just forgot to mention that they didn't have to go. So our understanding was, generally speaking, there was about 9 of these meetings per store in the metro area. So you can kind of take that out to those 19 stores and see it's a lot of lawyers and a lot of meetings that a lot of workers were kind of tricked into going to. Once workers arrived at the meetings, they usually tell them that they didn't have to stay, but not many workers were going to stand up and leave the meeting in front of the store manager, their HR director, and all of these high-priced lawyers. And then Lupe Cruz and Cruz and Associates, the lawyers who were present, proceeded to have a pretty biased conversation about what a union is. Certainly present it as education, but very clearly in the direction of, like, I think that same kind of anti-union propaganda that Emmett was talking about. Like, it's an outside party. They're just here for your money. They don't really care about you. That's the lines they would take through that same direction of euphemisms. It's interesting that you bring that up now as well, because this is the year we're actually going to find out how much New Seasons paid that law firm.
Ah.
They have to file records with the federal government, and those should be released sometime in late April. So it's going to be a pretty large number, I would imagine.
Yeah, that firm seemed to be able to, like, dodge that reporting requirement for the last year through technicalities, and for New Seasons, you know, had a hand in that. But interestingly, we did have a meeting with New Seasons management where we asked them a lot of questions about what they were thinking, kind of, when they hired this firm, and they admitted that they were aware that this firm could have had an anti-union bias. But when we press them about going back to the stores and correcting that misinformation, they were reticent, obviously, I mean, unsurprisingly, to do that.
Mm-hmm.
More recently, we, New Seasons Workers United, won some, so there's a board called the National Labor Relations Board that enforces federal labor law. And if a company, you can go make a complaint as a worker, if you're trying to organize and the company is acting in bad faith, is firing people who are organizing, which New Seasons did, is intimidating people, is interrogating people, is telling people they can't talk about the union.
Making threats about taking away benefits if organizing succeeds.
Yeah. And recently, the National Labor Relations Board found in our favor that New Seasons did actually break federal labor law by doing all these, engaging in many of these activities that we just mentioned. And we're required in four locations to put up a, unfortunately not in all the locations because it's relevant to all of them, but to put up a poster detailing New Seasons broke federal labor law. Here are the things that we are not allowed to do. And then signed by whoever the HR director is at this point. Those are up in four stores in Williams, Seven Corners, Central Kitchen, and Grant Park, I believe. And we feel like that's really important. That's an important victory. It's important that people know that, you know, this is like behavior that isn't acceptable,
yeah.
Especially from a progressive company, a company that calls itself progressive. So we tried to highlight some of that information. We put up some union posters with a little arrow pointing to it, mm-hmm. like, hey, this poster is here because New Seasons broke labor law. If you know, contact us if you have issues at work. And in all the locations where those posters were put up, they took them down almost instantaneously within 24 hours.
Not the posters, but the...
Yeah, they can't take down
New
legally.
Seasons Worker right. United poster yeah. saying, we got this.
Which is funny because on the federal statement, it says we aren't going to take down your...
One of the issues we ended up firing a ULP over was regarding union posters that we were putting up during 2017 and 2018 that they were removing because... New Seasons has a different definition of factual than the rest of the world, seemingly. Yeah. And that was actually directly clarified on the federal notice posting they had to put up. So,
And a ULP is an unfair labor practice. It's what the process is for filing complaint. Yeah.
So in your organizing process, where are you at? Are you trying to get a recognized union? You know, tell us what's going on there.
I think right now we're still on a lot of discovery on that. We're kind of looking at, again, what kind of union we want to be as we move forward. Right now, our focus is definitely rank and file. We really want to make sure that as workers, everyone has an opportunity to get what they need at their place of work. So we're focusing on bringing in more people, expanding our efforts in the stores, and making changes in the company. There's a lot that they're doing this year that we really need to hold them responsible for. So I think we'll be evaluating with our colleagues as we move forward what the best path is for us, whether that's going through an election process at different stores, whether that's associating with a larger union again. I think that's still in the future for us, but we're definitely going to figure it out one way or another.
Cool. You mentioned earlier that New Seasons is restructuring and there's some changes coming up. How are those going to impact workers?
There's a lot happening right now. We recently got confirmation from upper management that this is the year that the private equity firm that currently owns us is going to sell. So there's been very little communication or transparency on that within the company, which is very concerning because, well, obviously there's still kind of the looming prospect of when Amazon bought Whole Foods over everybody's head. So I think we're pretty concerned about even like where we're at right now, preserving those benefits and preserving that quality of work if we're bought out by a new company that maybe isn't interested in doing that. So I think it's a very large concern regarding how that sale is going to happen, what that new ownership is going to look like, because there was very little transparency with the sale to Endeavor Capital. And if that repeats, it's hard to imagine very many good things happening. There's been recently, we did receive a push to a starting wage of $15 an hour. And again, I'll also loop back to what Emmett said on that. That was a good goal to aim for a few years ago. It's not anymore. As it gets more and more expensive to live in Portland, $15 isn't enough. It isn't enough to survive on. And with that, though, has come quite a lot of hours cuts that aren't being well communicated to staff and that are kind of happening really under the radar for a lot of people. And New Seasons has stated that they're preserving hours for people, even if they're moving them out of departments. They're framing it as an hours transfer, but for a lot of workers, what they're looking at is they're looking at having to move to departments that have significantly higher injury rates and that require a significantly higher level of physical work. And the departments that are being cut right now, which include like our promotions counter, the sample counter, as many people know it, our floral area, our home goods department, and our wellness area, are all departments that have staff who've been in the company for a very long time, like 13, 14, even 15 years, who really, that's the right department for them. They have the experience and they have the ability for that department. And we're very concerned right now about, even if it isn't necessarily being framed that way by the company, staff being forced out because there isn't another department that they are physically capable of working in.
Yeah. We've just got one more minute, but I definitely want to hear what the community members like myself can do to support you guys and where we can find out more information.
Definitely. Our primary site right now is actually, it's our Facebook page. So just New Seasons Workers United. We have a pretty good page that we try to get at least like one good update post on once every week. That's a really good place to kind of stay up to date on if there's like, say, phone banking or calling the company or anything happening around stores that community members can help us out with, which we're always down for. We're very much about workers in the community being aligned on all of these issues. So.
We also are open always to workers contacting us if they need help publicizing fundraising efforts for workers, you know, who need medical bills, helping pay for their medical bills, things like that. If there are any issues at work, we, you know, lots of people in Portland know people who worked for New Seasons or work for New Seasons themselves. It's like kind of a thing that people, service workers, do in Portland at some point in their lives. So if you know people who work there who are having issues, feel free to encourage them to reach out to us. Our email is nswu17@gmail.com. And one thing that we have found that's not helpful is to tell cashiers when you encounter them that their jobs suck, because people don't like hearing that, obviously. Yes. So please don't do that.
I will, as a cashier, vouch for that.
Awesome. Well, Isaac, David, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break before shifting to talking about working on farms with Matt Gordon from Rogue Valley Food Corps. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Emily Becker. We've been talking with food system workers about organizing for better wages and working conditions at retail stores and fast food restaurants. These are the people that sell, cook, and serve us food. But what about the people who grow it? Matt Gordon from Rogue Valley Farm Corps is in the studio with me today. Rogue Valley Farm Corps is a nonprofit organization dedicated to training new farmers and also preserving farmland in Oregon. Matt also works on a farm called Cully Neighborhood Farm, and he grows beautiful vegetables in Northeast Portland. Hi, Matt. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
So I want to talk about Rogue Valley Farm Corps and their work to train a new generation of farmers. Can you tell us a little bit about their internship and apprenticeship model?
Sure. Yeah. So Rogue Farm Corps, as you mentioned, is a nonprofit that is our mission is to train the next generation of farmers through hands-on educational programming and preserve farmland. The way we do the hands-on education is through, as you mentioned, our internship and apprenticeship programming. Our entry-level internship program is for folks who maybe have not had agricultural experience before. Perhaps they've had some, maybe they've tinkered around with gardening or keeping some animals at home or something, or maybe taken some classes or done some like volunteer woofing or something here and there. But they're really interested in getting in a serious way and having a full season of experience. So the internship is a full season. It's typically April through October. It's full time. We partner with host farms who are passionate mentor teaching farms in four chapter locations around Oregon to host our internship and apprenticeship positions. And folks who are replaced with a position in internship, they live on site with the host farmer where they're placed. They receive room, board, and a monthly stipend. And then they're training hands-on day-to-day with the daily tasks of that farm where they are with a mentor farmer who is not just, you know, they're like an employer just telling them what to do, but it also explaining the whys of why they're doing it and exposing them to a wide diversity of tasks throughout the season. In addition to that on-farm training, we provide them with farm tours and classes and discussion circles throughout the season. So they're getting to see a wide variety of farms that are not their host farm. So they get to see how other farmers do it, see other production types, other enterprises, other systems. And then they're also given a fundamental education in the basics of sustainable agriculture throughout the season. So they have 15 to 20 classes on everything from propagation to soil science to grazing and pasture systems to cover cropping and crop planning and crop rotation, just to name a few. The apprenticeship program is similar in structure, but is designed as a two-year program for people who are already coming in with at least a season or two of experience under their belts, and they really are knowing that this is a path that they want to follow at that point. And so it dives deeper into training people on really how to manage and run farm systems, how to you know, run a farm business, more the business side of things, manage people, manage design systems, and evaluate, you know, certain enterprises, whether they want to try something new. So really the idea is that after that apprenticeship program, folks are well equipped to go out and start or manage a farm on their own.
Awesome. So I've heard that, you know, sometimes an internship program can be a little bit of an exploitative situation where a farm, you know, whether they mean to or not, might be just kind of looking for free labor or even labor that's going to pay them to work on their farm, which could result in, you know, people not being compensated adequately for the work that they're doing. But I know you guys are doing you have kind of a very robust program. How are you addressing that issue of people, you know, not being paid for their work?
Right. Yeah. So there's, you know, certain legal criteria to formally meet, you know, to qualify as an internship. And so Rogue Farm Corps started in 2003 with a group of farmers in the Rogue Valley in Southern Oregon, thus the name, of people who are passionate about passing on their knowledge. But it was fairly informal during the first few many years, and it had various incarnations. And then a lot of these concerns that you were mentioning started to come up around, I think, like 2009, 2010 or 11. And Rogue Farm Corps really took it upon itself as an organization to formalize its programs and structure it in such a way that we felt that we were really meeting those legal qualifications of an internship, and over and above that, like really focusing on the training aspect of the program and making it feel educational throughout. So some of the ways we do that, oh, and I should say that during that time where we were really formalizing the structure of the program, we were in conversation with the Bureau of Labor and Industry in Oregon and Department of Agriculture, and sort of telling them what we were doing and getting their feedback and advice along the way. Some of the things that we do to structure our program to keep it legal and keep everyone safe and keep it educational are on-farm evaluations. We check in with the interns and the host farmers and or apprentices and host farmers twice through the season, once in the middle of the season and once at the end of towards the end of the season, where we go through a whole list of skills that host farmer has agreed to teach and give experience with. And the participant self-evaluates, the host farmer evaluates, then we get together and we meet, we talk through all these skills. And it's a way to hold everyone accountable, hold the farmer accountable to mm-hmm. be teaching the skills that they say they're going to be teaching and giving the exposure that they say they were going to do in the first place. It's also a good time to discuss goals of the intern or apprentice. Are those goals being met? And then some of the other things we do are, like I said, we have classes and discussions and journal. We also require journals. So we have a bunch of requirements that make the program more of an educational program than just like an informal internship. So we have journals. We have projects that the interns are required to do. They're required to do record keeping of the hours that they're putting in on the farm. And we're checking in with the host farmers and the participants along the way to make sure that, you know, if there's any issues coming up or arising, we can address them. So we provide this sort of third-party support to both of those parties going throughout the season. And then we also have agreements, so written agreements that document all the expectations of each position. And they sign those at the beginning of the season. So everything is clearly laid out in terms of what people are expecting in terms of everything from housing to food to pay to hours to training expectations and all these different things. So those are some of the ways that we have a structured
That's awesome.
Educational training program. Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that, you know, there's kind of this enduring image of a farmer being an middle-aged white guy, even like an old white guy, but that's not the case in Oregon for sure, it's changing rapidly.
We hope so.
Yeah, both with you know, farms changing hands to new people, and then also a lot of work around supporting people who aren't white middle-aged guys to become farmers. Can you talk a little bit about your work on equity issues, on recruiting people of color to be farmers, things like that?
Yeah, this is a huge learning front for our organization right now. The fact is that the current situation in the U.S. and in Oregon is that the majority of farmers are, I mean, farm owners, farm business owners are older, white, and male. Mm-hmm. That's just the reality of it. And so, and we envision a future where the farmers look all different ways, right? So are much more diverse. And so in order to get from here to there, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. We are currently training our staff and our host farmers on diversity, equity, and inclusion issues and best practices. We have annual training for our host farmers that you know, we get everyone together from around the state. I mentioned we have four chapter locations. We have Eugene area, we have the Portland chapter, which I manage, the Central Oregon chapter, and then the Rogue Valley chapter. And so we actually, this coming Sunday, we're getting all of our host farmers together in Corvallis for our annual training, which this year is on sexual harassment. Last year was on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we are working the topics of the history of colonialism and agriculture and food justice into our internship program schedule, and pushing those topics forward into that you know, scheduler, which has been focused more on strictly agricultural topics. But we are realizing more and more that if we want to provide an inclusive, equitable environment for people to learn in, we have to learn about the history, and we have to, you know, put that front and center at the beginning of the season and say, this is where we're at. This is the context of agriculture. So those are some of the ways. And we're also working on creating community agreements and group agreements, and working with our instructors who teach our classes and talk to them about how to facilitate an inclusive environment in the classroom or on the farm at the farm tours that we do, things like that.
That's great.
We also are looking for other host farms who are, you know, people of diverse backgrounds. And as I said, it is like we're starting at a place where it's majority white. And so it's not easy to find that, like, but we are reaching out to folks and seeing where we can move in that direction.
Very cool. So I wanted to ask also, you're a farmer, and right now I know you're sort doing of. Less farming,
yeah.
But you've got a lot of farm experience. And, you know, we're talking about labor today, and we all know that farmers work really hard. There's just like, we all think that, right? Like there's no lazy farmer
right.
ideas out there.
Farmer.
Yeah. And at the same time, you know, most people, when you're buying food, like are generally looking for the best deal. Mm-hmm. Like you're always like balancing that out, right? So for a farmer, how do you, you know, how do you look at your labor costs, your own labor and any labor that you're employing, and then like the price that people are willing to pay for food? And how do you figure that out? And mm-hmm. what strategies have you come up with to make it so that you're not exploiting yourself as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a big question. And it's a really good question. It's a really important question. And there's not, unfortunately, there's not easy answers to it. A lot of people get into the small or sustainable or ecological farming movement, not because they want to make a bunch of money on it, right? They come at it more an idealistic standpoint of they want to provide good food or have a meaningful livelihood and be in touch with the land, take care of the land. And these are all really important things to keep in the forefront of your mind if you continue to farm. But you also do have to figure out how to pay the bills. And so people start realizing that after about a year of farming that, oh, wait, so how does this work financially, economically? And so they, on our training programs, they get experience in that through the fact that they're interning or apprenticing on real world commercial farms. I mean, they're all smallish family farms and they're dealing with the real economy. And so they see sometimes the struggles that these folks are dealing with. And we do an intro to farm business management at the end of that first season because they're starting to realize, oh, this is like the economics of this look like they could be potentially challenging. And so how do you figure out like how much you pay someone versus how much you charge? So there's a lot of work being done at the OSU level, Oregon State University, in partnership with Oregon Tilth, the organic certifier. Tanya Murray is a woman who works with both those organizations and is doing a whole bunch of work on cost of production in terms of helping farmers figure out like how much it's costing them to produce, you know, this pound of carrots or this, you know, this beef cow or whatever it is that they're producing. Looking at all the factors that go into it, and so that they can start to have a better like numbers to put on everything rather than just being having a sense of, I think this is costing me a lot, let me see how I can reduce it. It's more based in actual numbers that way. And so yeah, that's one way of doing it, but it takes a lot of extra work, but it's super worthwhile if you can actually end up putting numbers on things and you can start seeing, oh, this is actually losing me money. I need to stop doing that or figure out how to change that around so that it's more efficient.
Yeah. So unfortunately, we're almost out of time, but Rogue Valley Farm Corps is also doing amazing work on farmland preservation and helping transfer ownership from some of those older farmers to the younger generation. Where can people find out more about that and also apply for your training programs?
Yeah, so our website is roguefarmcorps.org, roguefarmcorps.org. And if you click on the farm preservation link when you get there, it'll tell you more about our farm preservation work. We do have an upcoming workshop if you're an aspiring farmer who is looking for land, or an aging farmer who might be looking to transfer your land. It's in Corvallis on March 6th. We have a bunch of other workshops too, and you can find out about them on our website. Also, our training programs are open to applicants right now, and you can, on our homepage there, you can click on farm training programs and learn all about them there.
Thanks so much, Matt. If you missed any of the show today, feel free to listen back to our episode archive on the KBOO website. It's kboo.fm. Thanks to all our guests and to our engineers, and stay tuned this afternoon for Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again next month on the third Wednesday of February, or of March, for another episode of The Food Show. Thanks for listening. The secret will travel.
The news is next. KBOO Portland. It's hard to take.